Today's show is a rebroadcast of one of our favorite episodes, Season 2, Episode 2, where we shared the lessons I've learned playing in jazz groups over the years and how those apply to business culture and teams. In this rebroadcast version, we've trimmed it down to just the discussions around the music. If you're a fan of live jazz, you can check out the original version from 2021, which we'll link to in the show notes. We've frequently done a version of this episode as a keynote presentation. If you'd like to talk to us about bringing this to your conference or your company, visit the contact page on our website, humanizingwork.com, and schedule a conversation with us. And if you want to support the show, the best thing you can do if you're watching on YouTube is subscribe, like, and hit the bell icon to get notified of new episodes. Drop us a comment with your thoughts on today's topic. If you're listening to the podcast, a 5-star review makes a big difference in whether other people find the show or not. Okay, on to the original episode. My first career was actually as a professional musician, and as I started working in the more traditional business world, I was a little concerned that I would have to learn a whole new set of skills to be successful there. But especially as I started taking on team leadership roles, I found that a lot of the skills that I had learned and really honed as a professional musician applied directly to the business world and helped me to be successful there.
Rather than just talk about this, we wanted to show you. So we spent some time with an actual jazz combo to see what we can learn for business and for teams from jazz. We are here to experience a different kind of team, a jazz combo, to see what business teams can learn from jazz.
And I'm here with four of my closest friends in a quintet that has never played together in this format before. So John and I just met before the gig. And I've played with some of the other guys in the band before, but this is the first time we've met.
So how are you going to manage that?
I think we'll probably rely on a few important things. So we have some shared repertoire that any, gigging jazz musician needs to know. And also we have some shared culture that we rely on. So Andrew, if you were to just show up at a gig and not know the culture, that might not go over too well, right?
Yeah, it'd be a problem.
It'd be a problem. So we have things around like as simple as what kind of a vibe you have when you walk onto a bandstand to like what order we're going to play in and how we're going to play melodies and kind of the form of the music. And it's all kind of shared patterns that we've learned.
So without you even planning it out, I could call a standard and
that's usually how the gig goes is somebody calls a standard. We hope we all know it and we start playing it.
Let's try it.
Okay.
You don't know what love is. Medium swing.
Okay.
Let's talk about what happened there.
Okay.
For most of our viewers who are not jazz musicians, we want to get into your heads a little bit. So as you're figuring out how to play this familiar tune with a new group of people in a new place, in a new way, what's going on in your head? How do you think about the decisions you're making as you do it? Or are you just playing the same thing you always play? I don't know.
You're drawing from your experience, obviously. Even though we all know the tune, because we haven't worked together, I'm not sure where Peter might take it. We know the structure, but he might do something a little different with the melody, and because of what he's doing, I may respond to that a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm. Was there an example of that in the last tune?
Shoot. The whole tune's kind of the example. I mean,
right.
And again, because we haven't in this combo played before together or even in this room, you know, sometimes a room will have a different feel and that, mm-hmm. and that will affect what you're doing. So.
I'll tell you the first thing I was thinking is, what key is this in again? And that's another thing is that, you know, we know a lot of tunes, but sometimes there are options for what key to play it in. And then I was thinking, okay, I think it goes like this on the bridge. So I was doing like a quick, okay, I think I remember the tune. But then as soon as I heard John count it off, and nobody told John to count it off, John was like, I'm going to count it off now. Then I was like, okay, all that, got to let it go and just play now so that I can be present, be listening, and responding.
Was anybody surprised by the key that Peter chose for the melody at the top?
No.
That's
standard.
The standard.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the standard.
Yeah. That would have been interesting.
if he'd started playing in a different key, yeah. would
I would have been cool.
Sometimes we might play in the same key, but the bass player, he might suggest, or the piano, any kind of, you know, accompanist, he might suggest different harmony, even though with the same melody.
Yeah.
So that's another, you know, we have to be open ears and adjust right on the spot, you know, sometimes go that way.
I think the feel was a unique call. Mm-hmm. So it took a minute for us to adapt. Typically, that song is a ballad. Mm-hmm. So we needed to figure out how the harmonic rhythm was going to move for us and mm-hmm. how the melody was going to lay over that. So that took a little bit of really careful listening. And the other thing is how we're going to carry the melody and how we're going to arrange it on the spot so that we can convey the most important aspects of the tune. And so a lot of times, like Peter and I, because we're horn players, our shared culture and history would indicate that we should probably play the melody first, or we should take that responsibility. Mm-hmm. And so he took the melody, and I thought, okay, well, we're getting to the middle of the song. I wonder if he's going to pass it off. Mm-hmm. So those were some things that were going on in my awareness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for a non-melody instrument, or mostly non-melody instrument, like the bass, how's that thought process different?
Well, listened first for what the rhythm would be. He counted it off, but I need to know where things start, and I listen to the melody for that. Mm-hmm. And I put forth my thoughts on the matter, so to speak, by first playing, but then I need to listen very carefully to see what's going on and make it all work. We all have our roles, but basically what we want to do is to make it work. That's our thing. We're all helping each other out and listening to each other and trying to make it work, trying to make it go. There's nobody going, oh, I'm right, you guys are wrong. It's all about hearing what's going on and helping it be better.
Have you ever played with a musician, Ted?
That's what I was going to say.
That actually was that way? I'm right,
yes.
And the rest of you are wrong?
Sometimes it was me.
What happens then?
Well, you don't get as much satisfaction out of it as you would like to. And, you know, the bumping of heads just sounds bad. You know, and the end goal is to have everything sound good and make the final product, which is the song, the tune, you know, the performance, be something unified. And if you're busy fighting on stage, that's not unification, that's fighting. And it doesn't help. So a lot of times you have to let go of what you thought was supposed to be happening and go with what's going on. Like I said, make it all work.
If I could say one other thing too, because of the performance aspect of what we do, it's a linear process, so there are no take backs. So anything that we do in the moment, whether it may be a mistake, even in my mind, Peter does a great job of creating a tone within the group that's like, okay, embracing that and saying, all right, well, we can't say, well, let's pause, go back and forget about that idea and plug something else in. We don't have that opportunity.
Yeah.
So we as a group there's a safety net, a comfortableness with everybody that they're going to try to turn that into something good.
Yeah, I had this instrument up originally, and then this valve stuck on one of the notes, and so it was all the wrong notes. And so I had to in the moment say, so now what should I do? Very quickly, it's like time slows down for a second when that happens. And I'm thinking, are there other notes? If I push this button down, are there other notes that would work here? And I'm really trying to, on the fly, fix it as quickly as I can. Or sometimes that'll happen, and the note that comes out is kind of cool. And so these guys will pick up on it, and it'll take it in a different direction. So sometimes a mistake turns into something pretty cool and unexpected.
Indeed, yes.
A happy accident.
That's right. Rest in peace, Bob Ross.
there certainly was a trust.
Yeah.
That could happen and it would turn into something.
Right. Hmm.
We had a couple examples in there of things not going the way you expected and having to be in the moment, whether that's a stuck valve or just what someone else does. Let's see what happens when we intentionally introduce some of that into the music.
Okay.
Shall we?
Yeah.
So for the next tune, we're going to have you play a particular tune. Peter has one in mind, I think.
Yeah, Summertime. Okay. Gershwin's Summertime.
Great. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to change the style on you or give you some other sort of guidance, throw a little bit of free radicals in there and see what happens. So I've got a stack of cards here with some variations that I will hold up. And then at an appropriate time after that, make it happen.
Okay. And so we're not going to stop then?
No.
Okay, so we're going to try and incorporate it like in the flow of the music and see if we can move to whatever the card says.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah. And we'll see how that happens.
What key are we?
Let's do this in D.
D minor?
Yeah, D minor.
About that 11
8. No, I wasn't. My mind was just going, oh wow, okay, now I'm thrown.
So what was that like?
It was fun.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah.
It was fun.
It was fun indeed.
It's a fun challenge, I think, to try and incorporate that.
When I was giving you all of those increasingly crazy cues, you know, a few of them in the beginning, like the bossa and Latin are pretty normal, but then when it started getting to 11 8 and more purple and things like that. How did risk and safety and trust play into how you approached those problems?
Well, I trust these guys to be musical and to be listening to me. And it makes me less risk averse. Uh-huh. I'm willing to go ahead and try to make a mistake, because you got to be able to make some mistakes if you're going to make some progress, is my feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, and about trust also, like, you know, when you mentioned something about the 11-8, you know, we didn't really know what's happening there. We just went for it. And then it's about trust. You just go for it, even if it's not 11-8. It just has to make sense somehow, so that's what we're going for sometimes.
I was playing in 11-8, Yanni.
Well, I didn't.
You're the only one.
Well, what's funny is I actually know a jazz tune in 11-8 by Chris Beebe called Merge, and so I just started playing that tune because it happens to be in the same key. Yeah. So I was like, I could do this one. This one's easy for me. Yeah. I think if you're not making a few mistakes in when you're trying to generate something, mm-hmm. You're probably not pushing it hard enough.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How does the context affect that? If you were just doing this in Peter's living room without a camera and lights and this going up on YouTube, how would it feel different? Or does it?
I don't know that it would. I mean, obviously, because the red light's on, you know, we're trying to get the performance right the first, you know, first take. We don't have that many, mm-hmm. you know. So that's an added pressure, but other than that, it really is no different.
Yeah. Also, I wanted, sorry to do that, but you know, something, just a thought that once we went to ballad and I took a solo, then what happened there? We're playing the song, but then Ted, he was playing the harmony where we started it, and then I doubled the harmony value, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. So it took us a little bit, and me, you know, tried to figure out where, you know, where their new form is at. Mm-hmm. So there can be, you know, the initial change, it happened, like from Latin we switched to ballad, but there's other things, you know, undercurrent there that we have to be also aware and try to adapt, you know, to what's happening and be as quick as we can and as smooth as we can, I guess. Mm-hmm.
What effect did the previous variations have on the later ones?
I think it was a lot about the harmonic rhythm, like Yanni was saying, is that when we went to double time swing, a form like Summertime is quite short, so we were trying to negotiate how to lengthen that. And so a lot of times we'll go into what we feel like is a double time feel swing, mm-hmm. So it's not quite a true double time, but it feels like that. But the harmonic rhythm is moving twice as slow. So I think at some point we were trying to stabilize that.
Right. Yeah, that was, I think, one of the things that stuck through most of what was going on is the beginning of how fast the chords changed stayed the same, even though within that we moved the rhythmic framework around. Mm. I'm not sure how that affected playing more purple was. But, you know, it all, the previous stuff always affects what you do.
Mm. For me, because the first few were kind of, I don't know, I guess in the realm of possibility, but you still had to respond to them. So for me, it kind of put me on my toes a little bit. Like I feel like an athlete stretches out before they, mm-hmm. you know, and warms up a little bit. I felt like by the time we started
Yeah, I didn't leave with purple.
Right. By the time we started getting to the more crazy requests, I was already like, all right, what's next? Just throw something else at me. So right. I felt like I was kind of looking forward to the next one. And then as they got crazy, I kind of wanted them to get crazier just to see how far we could push it and not fall apart. I think there's always a risk on a bandstand sure. that you could crash and burn and the whole thing falls apart. And I've been on bands where literally like somebody will just, all right, let's start over. Let's pick it up at letter C. And it's no fun, but it, you know, like it can do that. And if you're not pushing it to that, then it, to me, it's like it loses some of its edge and it loses some of the fun for me. So I like to push it a little bit.
Indeed. And also I wanted to add to that, it came to the point like after purple on the abstract, you know, it's for me, it felt like, all right, abstract, it's cool, I can do whatever.
Yeah.
Although it's not true because I still play, you know, around the group and I have to, you know, maintain a certain, you know, personality music-wise and everything. But it's good to trust again, you know, and just go for it and stretch, as Peter said. These are very important, you know, values to have on a jazz setting like that.
I didn't give the variations to you on the same cadence. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like I waited for a chorus and then brought it up again. Some of them were close together, some of them were further apart and at odd times in the song. What effect did that have on how you handled the change?
I noticed that sometimes somebody would do it right away. Like when we went to Afro-Latin, I heard Yanni right away start playing a montuno on the piano, that little dun-dee-dun-dun in the piano. But we didn't all exactly change at the same time, and so people picked it up. The cool thing is that happens even without prompting in a jazz scenario, is that somebody will say, hey, you know what would sound cool right here is this, and they'll start doing it, and then other people will either pick up on it, or we'll have fun with the fact that we're kind of playing in two styles simultaneously, and that creates some cool tension. So that felt pretty natural to me.
It seemed like different people took the lead on different ones of the variations. I was really curious when I put those up if it would always be one of you. I could come up with scenarios where it would be a different one, or it would always be the same person that takes the lead on it, but different ones of you took the lead on the transitions. How did you negotiate that?
Well, like for instance, when we did that Afro-Latin, I kind of went into an Afro-Cuban, mm-hmm. right? Like a little more, but then we were kind of in two different fields, so I finally had to just gracefully back out, yeah. you know, and then go with Yanni, because I felt, okay, that works. Ted was going with Yanni, so, yeah. All right, let me not force my agenda. Mm-hmm. Let me adapt to what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I, as usual, I was caught between two guys.
Yeah, you're in the middle.
I was caught between two guys. I heard what he was doing. I heard what he was doing, but I was... Yeah, I don't even remember why I went with him instead. Just
majority rules.
Yeah,
but you know, and the time where we went to 3-4, mm-hmm. I think felt like I led that one.
Yeah, I had
like
no
I started going boom, uh-huh. boom, yeah, boom, and you guys all heard that.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
negotiated that into uh-huh. three.
That was another situation where I felt like again, summertime is such a short form yeah. at that tempo of 3-4. Let's elongate. Like mm-hmm. we elongated that, so it right. was like a double.
Well, a lot of times the understanding that after we got the rhythmic feel happening was when you guys played the melody, mm-hmm. and that helped us solidify mm-hmm. that aspect of it, the harmonic rhythm,
yeah.
you know, with all this stuff that was going on.
I feel like for me...
Everybody just, had their role, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just personally, it was like, what do I think I can contribute or I feel strongly like oh, in this style, I feel like I have a thing that I can add,
mm-hmm.
you know?
So like
that was
funk.
That sort of like drove my decisions about when I was going to take the lead. And maybe, because if anyone feels like they have something really special to contribute, you know, and that, like everybody else can give way for that mm-hmm. to happen in a group that's really listening. And
we want to explore the role of constraints and structure in how you collaborate. So to do that, I've got a chart over here of Bye Bye Blackbird. And I'm going to ask you to play it exactly as written first. And then we'll have you play it as you would actually play it.
This will be hard for us to do because we're so used to looking at a lead sheet like that and immediately starting to play it in the jazz tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll do our best to play exactly what's written
yeah.
on the...
Show us what the structure you're given sounds like,
uh-huh.
and then show us what you do with that structure.
Okay.
For real.
One, two. Oh, one, two.
That sounded different than the first time.
A little bit, hopefully.
So what role did the structure play in how you approach that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, who wants to take that one?
It's like the size of the room you dance in. And whether there's what the furniture looks like in the room, you're still going to do a dance, but the room is a certain size. You got to dance inside of that.
So
with other people.
With other people, yeah. Right? It gives us a framework to improvise around. Mm. So that we never, I don't think, varied from the harmonic rhythm of it. There are certain chords that last a certain number of measures in a certain tempo. And we stuck with that, and it just cycles. And then we're improvising around that and through it and with each other and listening and... And sometimes we will break that constraint, but most of the time,
yeah.
No.
Okay.
The other constraint, well, it was interesting. Peter set that up at the end because
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of possibilities. We get to the end and everybody's looking, but we looked at Peter because he was playing the melody,
mm-hmm.
and that was going to dictate what we do. He didn't tell us how to do it. He just, by what he played, he showed us what he wanted to happen, and then it was up to us to figure out which way that was going to happen.
It seemed like it was a reference to some shared tradition, too.
Yes, some shared tradition. But we did it, each of us did it the way we thought we should do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Peter didn't say, oh, make sure to play that note there and then do this there, and then, you know, he offered that this is where we're going. He trusts us to do what needs to be done to make that happen.
There's a cool ESP thing that happens when everybody is listening. So we get into the vamp, and I was really happy that everybody got into the vamp together. And then there's the question of getting out of the vamp. And I just, for me, I played it until it felt like it had a natural arc. And I thought, all right, I'm going to just go out of this. And I don't know if everybody else is going to go out at the same time. And so I kind of played a different, but I don't even remember exactly what it was. But as soon as I played that first note, I heard everybody, okay, we're ending here, which is like, to me, that's, I literally get goosebumps. One, we can consistently, like, nobody had to say anything. Nobody had to, I didn't have to like make a big thing.
Yeah.
I just played a slightly different note and everybody's like, okay, that's like when it's really working.
So listening to each other really,
yeah.
you know, that's a very important, very, very important thing. Mm-hmm. Listening to each other, you know, and also the groove, like, you know, the drums and bass, you know, this is like the bass, you know, the whole song. Because if that collapses, it's gone. So it's probably the most important, you know, melody, of course, but melody without the rhythm and everything, you know, still it can be pretty and everything, but with this setting, probably the most important is the rhythm. So we only all have to pay attention.
That gives me an interesting idea. What if we take a song with a simple structure but put the drums on the melody?
Okay, Mike.
Sea Jam Blues.
Sea Jam Blues. You get to play the head.
Drums, yeah. Play the head.
And see where it goes from there.
Yeah.
the roles different there from usual?
Usually I'm probably not playing melody.
And what effect did that have on the rest of the song?
Well, we were kind of turning a little bit upside down. And so I think then as you notice at the end, it just allowed us to have a little more freedom. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay, we're going to really approach this different. We're going to throw it up in the air and see how it lands. And so you took away the structure by doing that, mm-hmm. because it was kind of going against the norm.
Mm-hmm. Or one of the patterns, right?
Yeah.
It took away one of the common patterns.
Right.
Which means we had to figure up a new one, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Not from scratch. You still had the...
We still had the structure. We still knew the tune, but it was a different approach.
Right. I think it made the whole thing more playful.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like for me, when Andrew and I were playing in half steps apart,
yeah.
which sounds like this, right? That was intentionally playful. It wasn't like one of us screwed up and was like, "Ooh, whoops, I'm in the wrong key."
The key's in the name of the song.
The key for this one is in the name of the song. Andrew did that, I'm guessing, just to be playful and be like, what would happen if I did this? Like a little devilish grin, right?
Yeah, and the melody is so short,
yeah.
You know, and very rhythmic. It kind of works.
Yeah, it totally
I thought,
yeah.
Well, we fell into some of the trope of Thelonious Monk.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, by having the rhythm be first and foremost, you know, mm-hmm. a very simple rhythm, and he played it. And then when you went to the half steps, which is also an aspect of Thelonious Monk,
mm-hmm.
we kind of leaned in that direction.
Yeah.
With that, which, you know, a lot of monk stuff is very playful.
Yeah, and simple.
And simple.
Often very simple too. Yeah, it's interesting because I wasn't thinking about Monk when we were playing, but as soon as you said that, I was like, oh yeah, that's the vibe.
That's what we did.
That was the vibe that we had, right? Which is again part of kind of the shared vocabulary. We've all studied the same masters of this art, right? And that's how come we can come together. And when somebody plays something that sounds like Monk, then we know, oh yeah, that would be cool. Let's go in that direction.
So that knowledge wasn't just tacit to the audience. Mm-hmm. That was tacit to you.
Yeah.
It was like you didn't know you knew that in that moment consciously, yeah. But you were using it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was a lot of fun to watch and listen to that jazz group collaborate. But we want to make some more explicit connections back to how this applies to teams in a business context.
Yeah, when we talk about these types of things, I'm always a little concerned that people will say, well, okay, I can see why a jazz combo would need to be really present and engaged and listening all the time and responding in the moment. But that's not the type of work I do. I'm not trying to make live jazz in the moment. I'm not improvising right now. So I'm curious, you know, some of your takeaways from that.
I think there's something to the time scale and immediacy of jazz.
Yeah.
That you're playing the song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think that same presence and awareness of what's going on with other people allowed, for example, roles to emerge mm-hmm. in some of the songs where somebody would take a different role than they normally did, like we experimented with in Sea Jam Blues with the drummer taking the lead,
right.
Which freed up other people like you and Andy to do different things with the melody than you otherwise mm-hmm. would have. And I've seen that same dynamic on teams in business where people are paying attention to what other people on the team are doing in a more present and engaged way. Mm-hmm. It frees them up to contribute in new ways and bring more creativity to the table.
Yeah, when you think of expanding the time span over the course of long projects or teams that work together for multiple months or years, the thing that I see on great teams is that they have moments of creative collaboration. And when they're in those moments, there's that same kind of flow state and that same kind of give and take and sense and response to what's going on in the moment where the nuggets of creativity like just almost seeds, right? Like they start to grow out. And so it's not like you're improvising with the jazz group 8 hours a day, 5 days a week for the length of a project. But there are moments, I think the more of those moments we can create on a business team, the greater it's gonna work.
And I think one of the things that causes those moments to emerge is working on small increments of value and getting frequent feedback about what you're doing. Yeah. When you're working off on your own for months at a time mm-hmm. without feedback, it's not going to produce that kind of engagement and creativity.
Right. Yeah. It's not actual collaboration at that mm-hmm. point, right? If you have five members of a team and they get their assignments at the beginning and then they all go off on their own, and then they bring it back together at the end. That's, as we define teams, that's not really teamwork. That's, you know, parallel coordination of work or something like that.
So this is another thing that we see kind of to an extreme in the jazz example, mm-hmm. is that you're working on the same song. You have a really clear shared purpose. Yeah. And Ted commented on this at one point, mm-hmm. that it was about the team making the music work.
Right. Yeah, that is the goal, is to make the music. And even the music has a goal, which is to move people somewhere. Mm-hmm. To create some kind of emotional state for people. And so the music almost is the medium that we're trying to use to move people. Yeah, yeah.
Another thing that I noticed there that applies to teams and business is the role of trust. Uh-huh. That as the members of the band trusted each other based on some shared tradition and mm-hmm. probably some transferred trust of somebody vouched for somebody else in the band. So even though you hadn't yeah. played together, you were beginning with a little bit of trust, mm-hmm. Like a new team with good reputations.
Yeah.
But as you built more trust by playing together, it became safer to take risks mm-hmm. and try things. And so in the song where I kept throwing different styles at the band, that created some safety where, you know, different people could try some crazy things in there and see what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And I there was also that moment I talked a little bit during the session about it felt like we had ESP. And that doesn't happen without trust. If I had done that at the very beginning on the very first song, I don't know if we would have built up yet the kind of shared presence to do that well. But pretty early on in that set when we were playing together, I realized these guys are listening and they're going to respond to whatever I do. And that's a pretty cool moment in a jazz group. That's also a pretty cool moment on a team. Mm-hmm. When you can throw an idea out there and maybe you're a little nervous because it sounds a little bit harebrained, but maybe it just might work. When you feel comfortable actually throwing that idea out there and you know that you'll be listened to and that people will respond and take the idea and work with the idea rather than judging me as a person for being the one to bring it into the room. That also is just very, I think, right in parallel with the benefits we get in jazz.
Do you think that the crazy thing we did on Summertime accelerated the building of trust in the band?
Yeah, it forced us to respond to change rapidly. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of like little mini iterations of how far can we push them and can we push them outside of that envelope of trust? But it's kind of like we talk about anti-fragile sometimes, right? This concept that from Nassim Taleb, from his book, that there are fragile things that break under stress and change. There are robust things that resist the change. There are resilient things which flex to the change but then return. And then there are anti-fragile things that actually get better in the presence of those changes. To me, it felt like we were becoming an anti-fragile group in that each of these crazy, especially as they got crazy, crazy curveballs helped us improve our level of collaboration, heightened how much we had to listen. And so I felt like that was an example of a real anti-fragile response to some pretty crazy requests. Thank you very much.
And I think you can build that on a business team by working on very small, valuable things, right. Working in very short cycles, for example, daily cycles mm-hmm. for even a couple of weeks in the formation of a team,
yeah.
instead of going off and doing your own thing for weeks.
Right.
Let's plan every day for a short time. What can we accomplish today?
Right.
And review it and do it the next day, and sort of daily sprints in the Scrum sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of the patterns that you and I like to use with new teams pretty regularly. And, you know, we don't stay there.
Right.
Right. Just like we wouldn't have.
You wouldn't do a whole concert of
exactly
changing the style every 16 bars.
But it's a good way to really exercise those muscles right at the beginning. And the team learns a tremendous amount about how well they can work together, what is going to prevent them from collaborating on a day-to-day basis, so they can start to address those things right away.
Finally, let's talk about the role of structure and enabling constraints. Mm-hmm. How did that show up in the jazz, and how does that translate to business?
Yeah, I think there was an interesting moment where Yanni was saying that when he saw some of those requests, if you will, his response was, oh, this is kind of, you know, tying me down. And it was, I didn't say anything at the moment, but what I was thinking when Yanni said that was, you know, we could respond to that request however we want to. It's not like if it says 11:8, we have to play 11:8. What would happen if we ignored it? And so I think it is interesting to push this idea of we're always at choice, right? Chris Avery's responsibility process is a great, has been a great tool for me to think about that, that no matter what's going on, I can be responsible for the choice I'm making in this moment. I don't have to feel like I'm obligated to do what somebody requests. I can take that request and morph it into something that I think is going to be valuable. So that was one of the things that I noticed when we talked about those, is that sometimes a crazy request is just a crazy request, but the way that our brains work is we might morph that into something really cool and respond in a way that maybe wasn't intended in the mind of the requester, mm-hmm. but that gets us a really cool outcome that was better than any of us could have thought of.
I think that revealed a divergence in purpose too, mm-hmm. Where with all the other songs, your shared purpose was, let's make the song work and do something good. In that case, I introduced a separate purpose, mm-hmm. Which is satisfy the request on the card. Play something that is really clearly in that style, even at the expense of summertime. Uh-huh. And I think different people in the band balance those conflicting goals differently, and you became somewhat misaligned there. Uh-huh. And that would have, I think, been something you would want to reveal on a long-running business team or even a long-running band and negotiate that.
And I see that happen on teams all the time, where there is a clear upfront, we've got a goal for a team, we've got a team mission or a vision statement that we're really aligned on. And as the team starts working on things, different stakeholders, they want some stuff. Mm-hmm. And it may or may not be aligned with that goal. And the way that we respond in that moment, I think, is pretty critical. We can respond to say, well, let's see, is there a way that we could morph that request in a way that is aligned with the overarching purpose? And that's really where I was trying to go with the requests. Or we might just say, well, it's not our purpose, but so-and-so said we need to do it, so we need to do it. You're going to get a very different outcome, depending on how you frame that in your mind, frame that request.
And we saw that actually get negotiated in the song around country, mm-hmm. where the first version of country was a country swing, mm-hmm. Which sounded like swing.
Yeah.
And then John didn't feel like he was achieving the country goal sufficiently. Yeah. And introduced that like two sort of feel.
That two beat. And I gotta say, like, that was, I think, one of my favorite moments in that, you know, in that song was when we went there, because all of a sudden, I found, I don't even remember what I played, but I found some melodic phrase that worked really well with it, and it wasn't summertime.
Right.
But it sort of reminded one of summertime. And so it was a really cool way to have a completely different variation on that theme than I would have ever come up with otherwise. And to me, it was fun and musical, and like I wanted to start a dancing when we played that point.
Yeah. Also along the lines of structure and constraints, it seems important that you've got the song.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, when we played it, just what's written on the lead sheet, when we played that music exactly, it was written. I see a lot of teams, especially new teams, that, you know, are supposed to adopt some process or something, and so they just go through the motions of adopting the process without improvising their own version of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what jazz musicians do is to improvise within that. I loved that metaphor that Ted used of, you know, the song is like the room that we're dancing in. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of teams would benefit from considering that same metaphor when they look at processes that maybe for lots of reasons mandated. You've got to use this process for good reason, and they can just feel like shackles to a team.
Right.
But if we were to consider those as just the room that we have to dance in, what kind of dancing could we do here would be a really interesting question.
Right. And maybe how can we dance in that space that makes the people who control the space see some new possibilities, uh-huh. and maybe change the space for us?
Yeah, absolutely. Love to see that happen on teams.
Yeah.
Good.
All right. Well, we hope you can take these ideas and other things we haven't talked about and bring them back to your team. Tell us about it in the comments. We want to hear what stuck out to you and what you do with this in your own work. As always, thanks for joining us.